You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. In just 10 years, the number of American children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, has risen by more than 50%, even though the number of kids grew by less than 1%. Over 6 million children between 4 and 17 years old have been diagnosed. Now, is this an invention of drug companies, a sign of an American culture looking for a quick fix, or are American children facing real difficulty? Behavioral neurologist Richard Saul has a very different take on ADHD. He's written a book on it called ADHD Does Not Exist, The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorder. It's published under the Harper Wave imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm pleased it brings Richard Saul to our show today. And I know a lot of you will be having questions about this book and this controversial topic, so we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can send them to our show page at WNYC.org. Now, Dr. Saul, the first thing I have to ask you is about the title of this book, ADHD Does Not Exist. That seems to be the most, inflammatory possible title you could have chosen for this book. When you and your publisher were talking about this book, was there any discussion about, maybe we'll take a title that won't be quite as provocative as that, or did you decide just to go for it?
Well, that was my idea, and I wanted to make a point. Mm-hmm. And the point was, ADHD is a group of symptoms, impulsive, distractible, short attention span. But I don't believe it's a disease. Mm-hmm. And there are, at least in my book, over 20 different conditions that mimic all those symptoms. And so that's why I say it doesn't exist as a condition. Reflexly, all of the doctors tend to treat ADHD with stimulants because it's ADHD. And there isn't any other condition that I know of that they do that way. They usually use what's called a differential diagnosis. They'll take the symptoms, make a list of all the things it could be, and then rule them in or rule them out. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's usually done.
So it's kind of, you're saying it's a made-up disease. It's a huge basket of symptoms that are then being labeled this very kind of generic label of ADHD. Is that essentially your point?
That's right. And people have told me that I'm old-fashioned the way I'm doing it. But no, I think that's the way medicine should be.
What do they mean, you're old-fashioned? What does that
well,
mean?
I'm just using old methods like, after all, everybody knows about thyroid and everybody knows about depression and everybody knows about all these conditions. This is something different. Or it's comorbid, meaning it's both two conditions at the same time. So at the beginning of the book, I quoted William Osler, who was one of the initial physicians who actually started Johns Hopkins Hospital. And he was saying, look for one diagnosis before you look for many.
Mm-hmm. So just to, again, get to the title of your book before we get into the nitty-gritty of what you're saying about ADHD. What is your response going to be? There are going to be people who say, well, wait a minute. I've been diagnosed with ADHD. I've been treated with stimulants for this, and it's worked. I'm doing better. I have a better I'm not as attention challenged. I have more concentration. So I think ADHD does exist, and I've been successfully treated for it. So what is this book all about? What are you going to say to them?
Well, there's a small percentage that would respond to stimulants, maybe less than 10%. So you've got 1 million new prescriptions this year. I would say if 10% respond well, then there's something wrong with the rest. Also, in these patients who do respond, there's really a question. Are they short-term responders? Are they long-term responders? Some people will react beautifully for a short term and then have to raise the dose and raise the dose and then switch to a different stimulant. And that's the protocol. It's ADHD, you give them stimulants. If that doesn't work, give them a different stimulant, raise the dose, and so forth. You've got to look deeper into it. Some people do respond beautifully. Others respond beautifully as far as focus and attention, but there are other things. They're irritable, or they are not cooperative, or there are other symptoms that aren't being treated with stimulants.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to behavioral neurologist Richard Saul about his new book, ADHD Does Not Exist, The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorder. We're on WNYC and WNYC.org. If you have calls for Dr. Saul, any questions you might have about his thesis, you can reach us here at 212-433-9692. All right, well, let's start at the beginning of this disease, which you say is not a disease, ADHD. It's one of several mental conditions that we really hear a lot about these days, along with, autism, dyslexia, to name just two others. What is the standard definition of ADHD?
Well, it's impulsive, distractible, short attention span, and they go on and on. There were 15 or 16 different criteria to make this diagnosis. Each year, the American Psychiatric Association changes the definition. They've changed. Now they're in their fifth change of how they define this. And in this fifth change, they've actually lowered the criteria to five or six different things that would make that diagnosis.
Right. On the back of your book, actually, you have a checklist, I guess, of things, symptoms that might, traits that might qualify you for an ADHD diagnosis. And there's something like, 20 check boxes, and then if you check only five of these, you qualify for an ADHD diagnosis. Why do you think they're lowering the threshold?
Don't know.
Don't know?
I don't know, but what it does is expand the group that get treated, and they get treated with stimulants, and it's a disaster. I don't think I know the drug companies have influence, but I don't think they influence this. I think this is what they sincerely feel is the right criteria. However, this April, after the word of my book was coming out, they changed and now have sent out a email to all the physicians saying, before you make this diagnosis, you should check their thyroid, check how much iron they have in the system, see if they have lead, low-level lead poisoning, and do all these questionnaires to check not just ADHD questionnaires, but depression questionnaires and anxiety questionnaires and all the other criteria which I had mentioned in the book. So I think that's a nice validation of what I'm doing by the American Psychiatric Association.
Now, people have raised doubts about this diagnosis before, and some have even called it a hoax. Arguing that we're seeing the impact of modern life, and that's all this is. How do you differ from those critics?
Okay. In the book, I wrote these 20 different chapters talking about different diagnoses. And the each one has a case history. It has main points, what you should look for if you're thinking of that diagnosis. And then there are a couple where the diagnosis is no diagnosis, that they just are bored or they are overstimulated and don't get enough stimulation, criteria that really aren't there, or they're gifted and some minor thing is enough to keep them from being focused and paying attention.
Are you ready for a question?
Sure.
from one of our listeners? Let's try, I guess it's Donna from New Jersey.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon.
Hi, Donna. Hi. How are you?
Good. I wanted to ask you, I'm a specialty teacher. I teach students, and some of them do take medication. At what point do doctors first suggest behavioral cognitive therapy, or is that something that should be implemented in a diagnosis prior to these kids taking medications?
Well, I think that they should all have behavioral cognitive therapy before they use medication. If people respond, then there's no need to go further. And especially in young children, any kind of behavioral rewards or anything that would improve the situation, giving them stars, giving them programs, would be essential. And I don't like to give medication unless we have pathology. And to me, pathology isn't that they can't focus or pay attention unless it actually affects their life. Because there are people who just can't focus but do, you know, succeed in life and go on fine. And some of them actually do better because they have that extra energy that they can use.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, I think Donna is talking about cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Are there case studies for CBT working with these symptoms that are often lumped into this overarching diagnosis of ADHD?
Donna, I don't know of any case studies that are through the medical things.
If somebody's already taking the medication and then you try to take them off the medication, can you unring the bell in that sense? Or has something already happened to them chemically or physiologically that now creates a crutch for them and now they have to take the medication continuously?
Donna, my theory is these are the small percentage of neurochemical cases that need stimulants. If they need them, what you're going to do is give them stimulants to make their stimulant levels in their brain normal. So they won't be addicted, they won't have a problem. And in my experience, 4 or 5 years of this is enough, and they can then start tapering off the medicine. In those that need their bell unrung, they usually shouldn't have been on stimulants in the first place because they're probably overstimulated and their body is now adjusted to a new level.
Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you, Donna. Now, even if ADHD doesn't exist, as you're positing in this book, there's still that question of why are we seeing this increase in the reported symptoms? Let's say their symptoms are attributable to all these other things you're talking about, like thyroid and stuff like that. Why is the spike happening?
Well, it's like over the last 10 years, you were mentioning this giant amount. The last year, 1 million new cases treated with stimulants. It's happening because a number of things. You've got drug companies that are pushing their products. A new one just came out this week, a new Ritalin compound that's longer acting. Not only the drug companies, but doctors don't have the time to go through the evaluation that I've suggested. The third part of the book is how to do these evaluations. And people can do this for themselves. We've given references and everything. It's a real disaster that's going on in this country. And I think that it really is unfounded.
I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Saul about his book, ADHD Does Not Exist, The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactive Disorder. It's published by Harper Wave, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and maybe you've been diagnosed with ADHD, or you know someone who has, maybe your child has been. Well, my guest says ADHD does not exist. In fact, that is the title of his new book. Its subtitle is The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorder. His name is Richard Saul. He's a behavioral neurologist. Well, right before the break, you were talking about the increase in the symptoms that we associate with ADHD, and you attributed some of that increase to the impact of the pharmaceutical companies. What's the mechanism by which that works? Are they talking to the doctors? Are there reps? I have this, you know, sort of, as many of us do, I have this sinister image of the pharmaceutical companies doing whatever they can to get drugs into us. But what's the, in terms of ADHD, what's the mechanism for doing that?
Well, they do come and talk to doctors. But more important, they're talking to patients. And the way they're doing that is through advertising. And you see advertising on every kind of medicine. Then the patient usually mentions to the doctor, well, I've got these symptoms and I read about such and such a medicine and should we try that? Well, a lot of doctors say, sure, we'll give it a try. And that's helping to do this. The Library Association wrote for all of the libraries referring to this book, and they said every patient and every teacher should have a copy of this book so that they can review and compare with what's going on in their world. But it is a disaster. And the disaster is pharmaceutical companies, the lowering of the criteria by psychiatric associations, and the fact that doctors don't have the time to do a good, thorough evaluation that a child or an adult needs to make a diagnosis.
Well, you call it a disaster, and the drugs that most often come to mind when you think of ADHD are Adderall or Ritalin. If they're prescribed improperly to somebody who doesn't really need them, what is the disastrous outcome of that?
Well, it isn't as sinister as as it might seem, but
I gave you that big buildup, and then you're letting me down.
No. They have trouble eating. They uh-huh. have trouble sleeping.
They lose weight.
They don't eat, so right. they do lose weight. One of the side effects is depression. Mm-hmm. One of the causes of ADHD is depression, and so you get a double whammy. It's depression that's creating the symptoms, and then they give you a stimulant, and that gives you more depression. So each condition has its own side effects, but if you have trouble eating and trouble sleeping, a lot of the doctors will then give you something to help you sleep better, something to enhance your appetite. That's not the answer.
Right.
You know, the answer isn't to cover up the medicine with some other medicine, and I see so much of that when I see new patients.
Okay, our next caller, Philip from New Haven, was on a number of medications because of this diagnosis. So let's hear from Philip. Philip, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for taking my call. When I was a kid, I was put on Ritalin and then Adderall because it wasn't working for me. And the Adderall caused me to lose my weight, as he was saying. So they switched me over to a tricyclic nortriptyline, which I had until college, and now I'm on Strattera. So I've been dealing with ADHD my entire life, but not in the stimulants since then, because the antidepressants are quite different. One of the things I wanted to ask was that for people like me and my family, various family members who have all had really severe symptoms like these that could not deal with it, we've had to face stigma about people saying that ADHD doesn't exist and that we can't deal, that we should be doing other things rather than having the medications that really, really help us to function in actual society. So I wanted to know what you had to say about that.
Well, I'm glad you found medicines that did help. And they usually are mediated by your neurochemistry. So had they done some neurochemical tests, which are not available everywhere, but Mayo Clinic does it, and there's a clinic on the West Coast that does those tests, they would have known right away that you were overstimulated normally. And so nortriptyline is one of the medications that lowers the stimulant level in your nervous system. And so that's why that would work. Strattera is another medicine that lowers the stimulant levels in your medicine, in your body. And so that tells me that a stimulant wouldn't have worked for you. Had they done these tests, you would have never been on a stimulant in the first place. And I wrote articles on nortriptyline in 1980s telling doctors that this is something they should consider and these tests should be run. Anyway, I'm glad it did work out for you. And as far as the stigma of ADHD, I'm just saying that there are different reasons why people have it. You do have it, but you're overstimulated, not understimulated, where you would need a Ritalin or a Adderall.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip. Now, Charles in Turtle Bay called in to say, this is a quote from him. He said, ADHD used to be a rich kid's disease. And I wonder about that. Is that true? Was it something that if you were wealthier back in the day, you were more likely to get a ADHD diagnosis than if you weren't wealthy?
Well, you could afford more to get the evaluations.
To get the evaluations.
However, it doesn't. It isn't a rich kid's disease. But what is frequently called a rich kid's disease is the kid or the parent who says, give my kid the stimulants because instead of B's, he can get A's and he can focus better and so forth. And people try and and convince the doctors to do that. And if the doctor doesn't have time, it's like, sure, give it a try, you know, that kind of thing. So
how widespread is that? I mean, I've heard that scenario, but how widespread is that, where people are just trying to get academic advantage? So they're saying, I want to take a drug.
I think it's fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
And they not only that, but once you get into college, your academics are coming at you from every direction. Each school that you go to, you know, moving from elementary school to junior high to, you know, to high school, have their own needs. And people where they would do grammar and then they would do spelling and so forth, all of a sudden they all come together and you've got to do grammar and spelling and composition and everything. And so some people who have trouble focusing then get pathology and get into problems. Same thing with college. And so sometimes legitimately these things come out, those symptoms come out, and we need to find out why. It's not just ADD, take a stimulant.
Now, in the book, you also discuss how learning disabilities and conversely giftedness could lead to misdiagnoses of ADHD. In the case of giftedness, if a kid is really gifted and might be bored with the curriculum in school and his mind wanders, that could be misdiagnosed. These seem like sort of, to me at least, obvious explanations for why somebody's attention might wander. Why are they overlooked in favor of this kind of, it's got ADHD, sort of generic diagnosis?
Let's talk about giftedness first.
Okay.
This is like the princess and the pea. If you recall that story where this princess couldn't get comfortable because somewhere under the mattress there was a pea, and so they kept adding mattresses to make her comfortable. Gifted children who have the slightest difficulty with focus and attention have a magnification of their problems because they know they've got a problem, and it's irritating to them. And so they're quicker to try and get help than somebody who isn't gifted. However, the people who have symptoms of ADHD are actually brighter than the average population.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm talking to behavioral neurologist Richard Saul, who has written a new book called ADHD Does Not Exist: The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorder. Let's take another call. Let's hear from Sam in Brooklyn. Hey, Sam.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today? I love the topic.
Oh, good. What's going on?
I went to a special school for about 7 years called the Lab School of Washington in Washington, D.C., where everyone had either dyslexia or some sort of learning disabilities or hyperactive disorder, ADD. And I was never put on drugs as a kid, but I noticed that the kids who were put on drugs before puberty seemed to have a lot more social trouble after puberty. And it really broke my heart when I was a kid because I felt like I was lucky. I didn't have to have drugs, and these kids I liked when I was, you know, 9, 10 years old, when about 13, 14 years old, they had a lot of trouble just being normal kids. And I was wondering if there's any medical basis for that.
Well, hi, Sam. Yes, there is. There's a condition called Asperger's syndrome, which is part of autism. And they're bright people, but they don't have good social skills. And that's one of the hallmarks of an Asperger child, is they have impulsive, distractible, short attention span, but also very poor social skills. They don't get along well, and they don't understand how to get along well with others. That would be a typical person.
Do you think that's something that could have been brought on by the medication, or is that just something that happens to these kids as they go through puberty?
Well, interestingly enough, in the last couple years, they've come up with genetic findings, and on one of the chromosomes is autism, depression, quote, ADHD, and bipolar disorder on the same chromosome. And the question is, are we floating between these conditions with the various symptoms? That's something that's yet to be evaluated.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Sam? I guess so. He's gone. I guess he's gone. Mission accomplished. While we're talking about learning disabilities, dyslexia is another one that comes up more and more. I seem to hear that all the time. It's another very commonly diagnosed problem. Is that being overdiagnosed as well, to your knowledge, or are you comfortable with those levels?
Yeah, they have good metric studies on dyslexia and how to test for that and find it. I don't think it's overdiagnosed. But learning disabilities, you know, it's an interesting topic. And we went to two schools to evaluate them for learning disabilities, Harvard and Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And at Harvard, they had a learning disability in organizational skills, and they were all over the place. But at lunch, they were so social and so vocal that you could hardly hear yourself think. Then we went over to MIT, and their learning disability seems to be in communication skills. If you talked about science or engineering, they would talk to you all day long. If you wanted a nice lunch with social interaction, you got yep, nope, right. A lot of that kind of thing. And it was a very quiet dining room. The point being, everybody has some learning problems.
Sure.
And you have to be careful when you make a diagnosis. Once again, it should cause pathology. It should cause problems, not just to run a test and say, oh, they've got dyslexia. Is this dyslexia that they can't really help? And therefore, does it need medication? Does it need extra learning disability help that many schools have and some schools don't because of the financing?
Now, another learning disability that I heard about recently, which was new to me, was dysgraphia, which is people have trouble with their handwriting, have trouble, I guess, coordinating good handwriting, writing good. I just had terrible handwriting all throughout school, and no one ever diagnosed me with anything. I don't mean to be making light of this diagnosis, but how real is dysgraphia? Is that a real thing?
Oh, it sure is. You should look at my handwriting. It's interesting. When I was in third grade, they had cursive letters around the top of the room, and the teacher said to me, "Richard, do you see those letters?" And I said, "Yes." She says, "Why don't your letters look like that?" And I said, "I don't know. They don't look like that." She said, "Can't you make them look like that?" And I said, "I can't."
Right.
And they said, "Then be a doctor."
Well, I don't know if that's a true story, but
It is a true story.
Okay. It's very, very apropos. Let's hear from Pam in Allenhurst, New Jersey. Pam?
Hi, Dr. Saul. It's so welcome to hear your perspective on ADHD, ADD. I wanted to add commentary or perspective. I was in the classroom during the 80s and the 90s, and I had, I wouldn't say handfuls, but it kept presenting itself, children who they were tagging as being hyperactive, and it was a truncated approach to it. It was that they were not fitting the behavioral guidelines of a classroom setting. Instead of working with the child and approaching them differently, meeting their needs wherever it was, it became a truncated answer to go to that they need medication. And it came from, a lot of it came from the schools telling the parents and the parents telling their pediatricians. And I felt it was such an injustice to children. Those children that I saw that were being treated, were under treatment, often looked to me like are exceptional people, exceptional in the sense that their abilities were very, very high. Not that they had such interfering abilities, but that they had very exceptional, that they were like our national treasures. They were extraordinary people, not someone who had what they thought of as a disability. And I have fought this for a long time, and I just welcome that you are putting that book out there to question why we keep moving this way. Why are we always looking at the differences of people as being that there's something wrong about them.
Yes, thank you. You know, I spent 14 years working with a special education district in the Chicagoland area, and so I understand the situation from both sides. However, they have a term called a bell-shaped curve, and these are the children that are outliers on the bell-shaped curve. They need their own their own way of being handled. I agree with you. And if they're handled that way, they succeed and they don't feel pushed down because they're different from other people.
Absolutely. It's the, that's the whole essence of what they need.
Right.
For the most part, there's there are obviously those who are in grave need in a different way, in a very valid way, but not the majority.
All right. Think of Einstein. He was... they're ready to put him in special ed because he couldn't focus the way they wanted him to focus.
So and, isn't it more about that the culture wants a shortcut to control behavior?
Well, the
and this
teachers
is just an
do.
Easier way to keep your children in line, keep them doing what you want them to do?
Pam, I'm going to be symptomatic of our culture and say that's all we have time for. I'm part
Thank
of the
you.
Problem, not part of the solution, but thanks for calling. I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Saul about his book, ADHD Does Not Exist, The Truth About Attention Deficit and Hyperactive Disorder. It's published by HarperWave. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.